from 10 to 1.
Mid-mornings with Linda Ness.
So I'm here with Ali from SubConquest, Ali being the hypnotherapist that was on the show before. I came in and had a session with Ali recently, and now we're going to have a little bit of a chat about it. So Ali, I came in and did a session with you in the hut. Can you talk me through what your sessions are like? How, you know, you're faced with people coming in like me, people quite uptight and scared to come in. So how do you cope with that for the first visit?
There's two ways, really. One of the things that I do is the first visit is free of charge, and I make a point of saying that it's an initial consultation where you get to interview me and make sure I'm the right therapist for you. So straight away, I'm putting the power back into their hands so that they're in control of that first meeting, and that eases it a little bit. But I am very aware that the people that come and find me, I'm pretty much their last resort, so to actually try anything again takes so much guts. So, I mean, the first thing I'll do is we'll sit here for 20 minutes and talk about absolutely anything but hypnotherapy, just to relax you, so I can get a feel for your personality type, so that we can begin to interact better together. Just completely cool it down. And I make it as much fun as I can, because it's the last thing people are expecting.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, what you did with me as well, actually. We sat in the kitchen for a little while, then we came out here, and you've got a great hut. It's a kind of garden. It's like a summer house, really, isn't it? And it's a lovely place, actually, very relaxing and chilled out. And it's in the garden, and you hear the birds and all that kind of thing. So during my session, let's go back to that. At first, I mean, I was quite uptight, I guess. And you had problems with me at first, didn't you? And we tried the number thing, counting backwards, and I wasn't doing that very well. And then you gently just kind of shifted to something else without me really realising it. And then gradually I started to relax and sort of chill out. And by the end of it, I felt very, very relaxed and chilled out, actually. That's normal, is it?
Yeah, but the difference between what I do and what a lot of other therapists do is I don't just have one technique, because one technique does not fit all. I started trying to get you relaxed by using a technique I'll use 70% of the time, but it was a technique that involves you being able to visualise. Now, if we'd have had a proper session sort of where we met and chat before, just by talking to you, I would know you can't visualise. So I wouldn't have even attempted that on you. But because we went straight into it, that's my excuse anyway. But no, seriously, that's another thing about the initial interview, so I can work out your personality type and what will work for you. As soon as I realised you couldn't visualise, if I'd have been trained anywhere except for where I was trained, I'd have been in a bit of trouble because I wouldn't have known another technique. But I was trained to have a toolbox that I can adapt to suit absolutely everyone that comes in. And the whole thing about, if you think about people that have come to me, they feel like they have failed. They wouldn't be here if they could solve their problems. So they feel like they've failed. So it's really, really important that whatever I do in here doesn't make them feel like they're failing. Yeah. So whatever I attempt to do, they have to feel and be succeeding, even if it's just relaxing into a trance. It's really important they feel they're getting that right. So it's up to me to make sure that I use the right approach.
I know that you've been really, really busy recently. You're getting lots of clients coming in, lots of different clients as well. And that must be quite a learning curve for you as well, I'm kind of imagining, as you're tackling different people and maybe some quite difficult cases that are coming in. That must be quite challenging for you too, actually.
It is, and it's not something that you can be taught while you're training to be a hypnotherapist. You talk techniques and how techniques will work with fears and phobias, smoking, maybe a little weight loss. But more and more, and I've noticed it the more that I work now, that I am attracting different types of clients, and they're coming with very, very varied issues. And there's a thing called secondary gain. An example, somebody that comes to me, they're overweight, and they think that their problem is they can't stop eating chocolate. So we deal with the chocolate issue, but they're still not losing the weight. Secondary gain is when there's a reason behind the obvious problem that they've presented with. And this particular example, this lady had some serious issues when she was a lot younger, and the weight was actually a subconscious way of keeping people away from her so that she wouldn't get emotionally damaged again. So until we got to the root of the problem, which is another thing that I specifically do, get to the root rather than cut branches off, we were never going to get her to lose weight. As soon as we realised what the weight was about. So no, it's learning on the job as you go, but it's just following procedures, knowing that all behaviour has a purpose. Find that root. If you find the root, everything else falls into place.
And going back to the session that we did, I can remember absolutely everything about it. So there's nothing scary about it. There was nothing frightening. I had my eyes shut, but I could hear your voice all the way through. I didn't actually feel like I'd been hypnotized. Now, you said that might well be the case, that a lot of people just don't feel. Or does anyone ever feel like they've been hypnotized? What does that feel like?
Yeah, people come with a preconception of what hypnotism is. They're expecting to not remember anything about the session and be completely out of control. And I always tell everybody that comes here, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to get you to lie there and relax, and I'm going to get you to think about various things, and I'm going to be chatting away, and you'll listen to me or you won't. You'll hear everything I'm saying. You'll hear all the noises outside. And I promise you, you'll be lying there thinking, well, this isn't working. I'm not in a trance. Not good at all. But the other thing that I always do, before we start, I always say, this will take no more than 10 minutes. Is that all right? Just 10 minutes. I'm just going to chat away. You daydream, do whatever you want. At the end of a session, I ask them how long it took. And they said, oh, 10 minutes, because that's what I've told them. The truth is, it's usually half an hour to an hour. So they were in a trance, but in a controlled trance. So completely aware of everything going on.
And there were moments, actually, I remember you saying, in a moment, I'm going to speak to your subconscious, I think you said, or it was something close to that, anyway. So you were kind of differentiating between having a conversation with me and having a conversation with my subconscious. That's presumably quite deliberate as well. That's part of what you do.
I mean, all the conversations that I have, you are aware of consciously because you're not asleep. But everything that I say has a purpose. My language is always quite eloquently vague because I'm not going to suggest anything to you. One, because you wouldn't take the suggestion. But two, everything you need to get you where you want to be, you've already got inside. It's locked away in your subconscious. And by being eloquently vague and actually saying, subconscious, are you listening? Your subconscious does actually pick up on what I'm saying. And certain key words, if say I'm speaking directly to your subconscious, I'm going to say certain key words that are relevant to helping you move on. And your subconscious takes those words on board at a very deep level. And that's what makes a difference and makes a change. Majority of hypnotherapists, literally, they are given a script. And most of them have to sit there and read it as well. And the reason that a hypnotherapist will make you shut your eyes, not me, by the way, but the reason a lot of them make you shut your eyes, is so that you don't notice that they're sat here reading a piece of paper. The same piece of paper that they read for everybody that comes with the same issue you have. If you listen,
so
you'll hear.
So the script for overweight, and they've got a script for smoking and all that kind of thing.
Exactly, but it's not. I disagree with those, and I never use scripts. I completely trust myself to ad-lib based on everything I know about that person from our initial interview, because everyone's so very different, their personality type is different. Mm-hmm. We've already discussed you couldn't visualise the numbers. Mm-hmm. So then I have to change my language as well, because if I'm asking you, if I say, and you might see this or you might see that, that's the wrong word to use with you because you don't see. I'd have to use feeling words with you because you feel things rather than visualise. And it's all about you doing that without a script and making it very, very specific. And that's what makes a difference between being a successful therapist and being one that drags it out for months and months and you don't feel like you're getting anywhere. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm getting the results as quick as I am, because I make the effort to make it about you. Yeah. And I can't keep a script about you because it will not work for anyone else. It's very individual every time.
from 10 till 1.
Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe.
I'm very pleased to welcome into the studio this morning Jenny Knotts, joined also by John Hutchison, a young man with Down syndrome. Jenny herself is a little disabled too. That doesn't make any difference in life, or it shouldn't do these days, really. They're my mid-morning guests this week. We're going to have a chat with them now. They're from the Menelik Education and the Real Life Trust. Welcome to you both. Good morning. Thanks for coming in and seeing us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, I really want to try and find out a little bit more about Menelik Education versus the Real Life Trust, because I guess they're two separate organisations. You may want to put me right on that point. I do my little bit of research, but it'd be nice to ask you both. Ladies first, start off with you, Jenny. Which organisation, you're involved with them both. Could you tell us a little bit, firstly, about the Menelik Education?
Menelik Education, it's based in Kinshasa, which is in the Congo, and it was my mum's friend Theodore who set it all up, because he's Congolese himself. So it was basically him who set it all up. And it's to help children out there with their education and basic general welfare. And I actually had a wheelchair which was too small for my mum's house, which is quite small, and there was a boy out in the Congo who couldn't get around, and he basically couldn't get to school. So I'd actually donated that wheelchair to that particular boy, and it went out to the Congo, and it means that he can now go to school and do all the things that his friends are doing.
Just giving him that mobility then, Jenny, means that he has much more freedom and independence in life.
Yep.
Isn't it marvellous to know? Because, well, first of all, we should explain who Theodore a little bit. You mentioned Theodore. He's Menelik, hopefully I'll get the pronunciation right, Mufuni, is that right?
No, it's Menelik Education.
Right, and given that his name is Theodore Menelik, so I wondered whether he was the founder of the organisation. I believe he is, and also the executive director too. And he's a visiting lecturer in social sciences, and I guess he's over here at Cambridge at the moment. Have you met him?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a very great prime mover and a wonderful man to be doing what he's doing. He's got a website as well. We'll give you more information about that site. And so, John, it's nice to see you here too. This is your first time on Cambridge 105. I know that Jenny's been here before.
Yes, I have, yes.
You have been on before, right?
Yes.
Because I know Linda Ness has certainly met Jenny before on her mid-morning show recently. Therefore, John, we'll ask you about the other half of the cake, if you like, in the Real Life Trust. And what's that all about?
Well, the Real Life Trust that supports people really in personal budgets, personal assistance, and there are also social work student unit as well, and they do have other projects and partnerships like Funky Flamingo and Blitzlips Stortford Mancap, and also the other partnership we have got as well.
So you find a huge passion in what you do, I guess, to help support them. Or is it a case of a feedback where they support you in turn? Do you find that being involved and engaged with the Real Life Trust, not only, I guess, it must improve your self-esteem as a person, but do they give you plenty of benefit as well?
I think so, because Real Life is very most popular charity, and Funky Flamingo charity. That's why we need more funding, because to get Funky club nights back at the junction.
That's why you've been doing them before, at the Cambridge Junction.
Yes.
So at the moment you're going to use a venue on Friday, which is really good news, and let's give that a little bit more publicity and spotlight now. You're going to have an Ubuntu party down at St. Philip's Church Centre in Mill Road.
Ubuntu.
See, I'm not getting it right.
It's okay.
Ubuntu. That's actually how it is written down on my screen. So that's really what I should be saying. Thanks. Well, tell us a bit about what an Ubuntu party is then, Jenny.
Okay. Shall I use my script?
Yeah, go on. Go ahead,
okay.
Yes.
Is it okay if I read it now?
Yes, please do.
Okay, thank you. Hello, funky friends. Funky Flamingo is back and proud to present our fellow company we are in partnership with, the Ubuntu Club. Our combined event that is this Friday at 7 p.m. till late at St. Philip's Church, Mill Road, Cambridge.
And is everybody welcome? Is it open door for everyone to go along to?
Well, it's for people with learning disabilities or without.
So parents, maybe brothers, sisters can come with you?
Yeah. And also there's lots of people from other organisations as well that they are coming to come along.
So that's kind of nice because you can have a bit of a forum going on to talk to other people with various different disabilities. I guess both physical disabilities and some cognitive disabilities too that will be joining you for the evening.
Yeah.
And so what time does it start actually? I didn't catch the start time. Would be sort of...
It starts at 7 p.m.
And really you would like probably a few more people to come along, maybe people who are involved with MenCap, for instance.
Yes.
As well as people from, and I've written it down phonetically, Jenny, so I make sure I get the spelling of Ubuntu right. That's better, isn't it? And so various other organisations that might be around Cambridge that's supporting people with disabilities.
Yes, there is. There's about odd thousands out there to get involved in real life. Trust or Funky Flamingo.
And so the idea, John, you were mentioning a little earlier on about the Cambridge Junction, so obviously a big venue with respect to St. Philip's Church. It's wonderful down there. And we obviously, a couple of years ago, had a bit of a refurb in the building, and it's a lovely premises. Although I've only walked by and stared in through the window, I can see that. It's very easy to see just down the other end of Mill Road towards the Brookfields end of Mill Road, which is obviously a mile long, so it's quite a way down there. But also, I guess you've got the idea to take it forward to a bigger venue and get it back to somewhere like the Cambridge Junction eventually.
Yes. Well, there is another venue which is bigger venue near Madden Lee. It's a big sports centre. And hopefully we raise enough money. Hopefully we can have future events like Ubuntu events or Funky Flamingo.
Hopefully it will grow and grow, sort of roll like a snowball, like an avalanche coming down the hill and get bigger and bigger and bigger for you.
Yeah.
How often would you want to hold these events, and how often, frequency wise, have you done this in the past?
Well, it's every twice. Month, and we also getting more people involved, and at the moment I am the Funky Flamingo coordinator as well, and we're trying to do some work on that.
Must leave you very busy, John, doing that.
Yeah.
Because you've also got a part-time job as well, working... I know that, Jenny, you work a couple of days a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And, John, how busy are you?
I'm working about 4 days, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays, from 9 p.m. to 5 p.m.
That's quite a busy man.
Yeah.
To find time to fit all of this in. So it's done quite a lot for your self-esteem and confidence. Any more plans to get other wheelchairs? Focusing again on African countries, Jenny, to get more aids to disabled people who are obviously not so well off as us in Northern Europe with all generally our world of affluence. I say that loosely, of course, but... You'd like to get more support down to sort
yeah,
of
if we can.
The hotter climes in those countries too. It's interesting to say that over 650 million people around the world with disabilities in every region of the world, in every country, persons with disabilities often live on the margins of society, deprived of some of life's fundamental experiences. They have little hope of going to school, getting a job, having their own home, creating a family and raising their children, socialising or voting. Persons with disabilities make up the world's largest and most disadvantaged minority. The numbers, according to the United Nations, are damning. 20% of the world's poorest people are with disabilities. 98% of children with disabilities in developing countries do not attend school. Around a third of the world's street children live with disabilities, and the literacy rate for adults with disabilities is as low as 3% and 1% for women with disabilities in some countries. John and Jenny, I guess you know this, and it's yeah. probably one of the reasons that drives you on to do the kind yeah. of things that you're doing on a Friday evening. So will this also be a fundraising event?
Yes, we are making money for Ubuntu events and also raise money for Funky Flamingo because we are trying to get more events happening, and we have got two events coming up at Strawberry Fair on Midsummer Common, and the other one at Cherry Hinton Festival.
I hope to see you there, because Cambridge 105, I hope, I don't want to talk out sorts, we'll be doing our live outside broadcast from Strawberry Fair this year, so it'll be lovely to come and see if you have a marquee or a tent going there. Thank you both very much for coming in to see us today. That's really nice of you. And, well, I hope that you get more and more members joining in as well, and more people around you, a bit of camaraderie and group spirit, because it's nice to see both of you working together today. Thanks for coming by. And when you've got some more things going on with the Menelik Trust and Education, all these groups, then do come in and let us know and publicise them. Why don't you do come back and see us again, either myself or one of the other mid-morning team. We'd love to see you. You can find out more on about the Menelik Education, if you like, organisation, by going to their website, which is menelikeducation.info. So spelling that, M-E-N-E-L-I-K-E. Well, it's education, so it's Menelik, M-E-N-E-L-I-K, and then just education, or one word, .info. Well, Jenny and John, thank you once again for coming by.
Afternoons with Matt and Ellen.
So it is now 2:30, and I'm pleased to say that our guests this afternoon are Simon and John from the Cambridge Cycling Campaign to talk about their work and, more importantly, the campaign itself. So a very good afternoon to you both. Thank you very much for joining me and Ellen on Cambridge 105 this afternoon.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
And first of all, tell us a little bit about your backgrounds in cycling, starting with you first, Simon.
I have cycled to school as a child along actually the busy A47, which comes through our region, but it's when I lived in Leicestershire. And I had a chopper bike then and cycled up a big hill to the school. So I've pretty much been interested in cycling throughout my life.
And what about you, John?
I also cycled to school, and I've cycled to work, I think, for my whole career. Cycle through London. I do 20, 30 miles a day, and I'm still cycling now, so...
I don't cycle that much.
I was about to say, what your legs like after that?
They were fairly firm, I would say.
And tell us a little bit about the Cambridge Cycling Campaign for people who haven't heard about the organisation before.
Okay, do you want to do that one?
Yeah. We exist to for 8 to 80-year-olds. We want more cycling, safer cycling and better cycling facilities. So that's our simple aims. In the Cambridge area, not just Cambridge, but we go out to the villages, sort of roughly 5 to 7 miles out.
And do you find Cambridge a very cycle-friendly city as it currently is?
I would say in UK terms, it's very good. But in international terms, it's quite poor.
So you're saying there could be room for improvement?
Yeah,
there's
a huge room for improvement. But
When we set up the cycling campaign sort of 20 years ago, in fact, the city had actually just banned cycling from the city centre, and actually a lot of people don't really know that anymore. But yeah, you couldn't actually cycle in the central streets of the city, and that ban was in place for 13 years. And in fact, the Tour de France, which is now coming to Cambridge, is actually going to cycle through those very same streets that were banned. So we think that's a big success.
It's a bit ironic then.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about the Tour de France in a couple of minutes. But I was looking over your website the other day and I noticed that you've got a cycling vision for 2016. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, that is our, yes, that's our plan to basically have a comprehensive sort of network of cycle routes throughout the city, extending out beyond the city to the villages. And because we have a really lot of cycling in the city, once you get to the edge of the city, it sort of dwindles off. And the reason for that is basically because the roads are pretty scary there places. And in the last few years, there have been some really good schemes that have connected, for instance, Horningsea to the city and Wandlebury. So we'd like to see more of those extending out because people want to cycle, but they'll only do so if they feel it's safe to do so.
Well, that's right. And I noticed on your website you're also doing a lot of work around junction awareness and trying to get a lot of junctions improved around the city and the neighbouring villages.
Yeah, absolutely. Junctions are very important. They're actually where most of the accidents happen. So junction improvement, though it's not as attractive necessarily and is also more expensive to do, is actually where you need to put the money and the time. As well, you know, actually going between junctions is actually the safer bit of cycling, though it may not always feel that way.
So how would you like to see junctions improved in the Cambridge area? What would you like to see on them to make them more friendly for cyclists and obviously easier for car drivers to spot the cyclists as well?
Well, I mean, quite often we see that too many sort of motor vehicle lanes have been put in, crammed in at a junction, which is not really big enough to take them. And that results in cyclists being squeezed. And for instance, we've got one on Milton Road, Gilbert Road at the moment, where there is two lanes of traffic and it's really quite dangerous. Well, it feels unsafe for the cyclists to actually go through that. So actually many of them are actually cycling on the pavement, which we think that's a real problem. We don't like people cycling on the pavement.
We can get a fine for it, can't you?
Oh, you certainly can. Yes, and you know it's wrong because that's the pedestrian the footway is where the pedestrians are. So we actually want to see provision made safe for cycling on the road. And so in the case of that junction, it's really great that the suggestion is to take one of those motor vehicle lanes out and make it into a wide cycle lane.
And these are the segregated cycle lanes, aren't they?
Not at that junction, but on Huntingdon Road and Hills Road, that's what's proposed there, yeah.
What's your thoughts on these segregated cycle lanes then? Do you think that's going to make things easier for cyclists and encourage more people to get out on their bikes rather than use four wheels?
Yes, I do. I think they're very important, especially for younger people and older people, the less confident cyclists. So, you know, in some countries, in Germany, for instance, 90% of secondary school children go to school on a bike. And in this country, not in Cambridge necessarily, but it's complete reverse. It might be 2%. So, you know, in a normal Western society where there's high levels of car ownership, it is entirely possible for almost all children to go to school on a bike in the secondary sector. And that obviously frees up parents to do other things. So, you know, it is good. Just go back to the junction side. One nice thing you can do at junctions is have pedestrians and cyclists all crossing at the same time. So you shut down the junction, we all cross, mingling together, and then the cars go. And that's quite a nice way of getting people across, rather than our system, which always has one cars flowing somewhere at some point.
You mentioned about sort of children and the lack of children actually going to school using a cycle. Do you think schools should do more to encourage children to bike rather than getting their parents to take them to school in a car?
Absolutely. There are lots of benefits. Fitness for the child. They arrive at school feeling better. There's evidence to show that they perform better at school because exercise does actually make you feel good. And obviously it's good for the environment.
Makes them more independent as well.
Independence, they can go home. There's a really lovely
thing.
Children
actually want to cycle, yeah. Don't they?
You see
they
children in Cambridge, yes. Go home as a little group. They all go to their friend's house and go and have a whatever they do. And then, you know, they can do that spontaneously. There's no date. There's, you know, the parents. And also, if you children cycle school, it cuts down on congestion for other motorists who have to use a car. So, you know, there are so many benefits and cuts down on noise pollution. It cuts down on air pollution. You know, anyone who lives on a busy road would love to have less traffic. So, you know, was...
But quite rightly, I mean, parents are concerned about that. And in fact, the quality of cycle training that's given at schools now has gone up markedly with the introduction of the bikeability schemes.
They used to call it cycling proficiency, I think, yeah. Didn't they, many years ago?
I did one of those, yeah. I did one of those.
It was, yeah. Ago, yeah.
Yes, and my memory of cycling proficiency actually is cycling around a school playground, which doesn't teach you anything about the reality of cycling on the roads in our city. But bikeability has changed that. So although they start off briefly in the playground, once you've got those basic control skills, you're out on the road.
Something I've also discovered on your website is you're doing a lot of things around cycle parking and making sure there's availability for people to actually park bikes safely and securely without having to worry about them getting stolen.
You bet. Yeah, that is a big one. I mean, anyone who tries to park their bike at the railway station, have you tried to do that, John?
No, but it's a nightmare. And it's so bad for visitors. They come to Cambridge expecting this wonderful medieval city, and what they see is a pile of rotten bikes. And they also have to, you know, there's lots of bikes on the pavement going out of the station. And I have friends who comment on this, and it's such a bad advert for Cambridge. The station is a mess. I know they're going to change it, but why, you know, we shouldn't wait.
It has been a long time.
Yeah, it has been a long time.
I think is it a year or two? Within a couple of years, anyway, we should have a 3,000... place cycle park at the railway station, which will triple the current capacity. We're not sure if that's enough.
That's right. I think that comes down to a lot of the time the cost of actually implementing the scheme and actually getting the racks put in. Although some people say it's inexpensive, I suppose the local authorities would say it is quite an expensive thing to do because they need to make sure it's all safe and passes the relevant health and safety inspections.
Absolutely.
And
well, I mean, the thing is you can get 10 bikes into the space of one car, so it's actually much cheaper to actually create spaces for the commuters who want to travel to the station by bike than it is to cater for that same number of, you know, parking a ton of metal there for the whole day.
The other good news about the station is that the proposed Chisholm Trail, which is thanks to the council being given support, will lead all the way from the northern busway, essentially along, not quite along the route of this railway, but it'll cross the river, it'll then track the route of the railway approximately to the station, which will allow lots of people who live in the north of Cambridge to be able to get south towards the station with relative ease, and sometimes about things like you're able to go under Mill Road rather than across it, and you know, so it'll be good for kids. So it'll you know, you want to go to Leisure Park, for instance, you will go there without necessarily crossing a road.
You mentioned Mill Road there, and I quite often have to travel down Mill Road in a car, unfortunately, and there is obviously the ever-increasing number of cars vying for space with cyclists on the road, and it can be quite hair-raising, and I have seen a number of cyclists, unfortunately, come off their bikes on Mill Road, and obviously a lot of it is revolving around safety awareness for car drivers, but also safety awareness for cyclists as well, making sure you wear the protective equipment like helmets and things.
Well, we think helmets is a matter of personal choice, and the other side to helmets is there are two ways of improving safety. Obviously, one is this training of a cyclist or wearing high vis or helmet, but the other one is, which is actually more important, is for the driver to be aware, because they're the one who's doing the damage in almost all cases. So actually, what we want to do is get drivers. We want law-abiding.
Training is the key. Actually improving the safety of cycling, or it's one of the measures that you can use. But we've also seen recently the introduction of a 20-mile-an-hour limit on Mill Road, and in fact the city is now forging ahead with that sort of a citywide 20-mile-an-hour scheme, and that's the kind of scheme that should tackle that sort of problem. But you still do get the problem. In fact, I had it on the way here today of close overtaking of motor vehicles when you're going over that bridge, because you know people are, I guess, impatient, and they need, you know, they've been held up and they see a gap and they try and take it. So it's a hard one to solve, actually, funnily enough.
Yes, indeed. And moving on with the interview, is obviously, well, time is vastly running out for us, and the Tour de France comes to Cambridge on the 7th of July. What was your thoughts when you heard the news that the Tour de France was going to be coming through our little city here?
It's great for cycling, it's great for Cambridge that it's coming here. As I said earlier, you know, we've gone from a city that's banned cycling to actually one that's having the world's biggest annual sporting event coming through our streets.
And it says something about the reputation of Cambridge, actually, internationally. Yeah. That's what's key, is that Cambridge, you know, has the highest number of cyclists of any city in the UK. And, you know, they chose Cambridge for a reason, and that's because it is a cycling city, and we need to just go further with that and improve it and let people enjoy cycling to work. Is great because you can go door to door. You know, you don't have to park. You can park at the door. Not everyone, obviously, but, you know, it's potentially there.
It can
be quicker than going by car.
Can I just butt in and say, yes, the Tour de France is coming to Cambridge on 7-7, but on 5-5 we have the Reach Fair ride.
Of course, tell us more about that.
Yes, which is on Bank Holiday Monday. We've got, this is our annual bike ride, which goes from the centre of Cambridge out to the 800-year-old fair in the village of Reach, which is about 14 miles away on the route that we go. Last year we had an amazing 600 because we had such good weather. If we get that weather again, we could beat that, because we've got the mayor and we've got the additional sort of promotion from the Tour de France. We've called it Le Reach Ride this year.
That's very exciting stuff. And if people want to find out more information about the Cambridge Cycling Campaign and your work and sort of upcoming events, where would you point them in the direction of?
Oh, well, you should go to www.camcycle.org.uk or just look for Cambridge Cycling Campaign online.
Wonderful stuff. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you both, and best of luck with your campaign work. And let's hope that the event you're staging on the 5th of July is very successful in encouraging more people to get out on their bikes and cycle safely and utilise the routes that we've got in and around the city.
Many thanks.
Thank you. We really appreciate your invitation, and thank you for having us.
No problem at all. That was Simon Nuttall and John Hall from the Cambridge Cycling Campaign talking about their work here on Cambridge 105.
From 10 till 1.
Mid-mornings with Linda Ness.
I am very glad to have with me in the studio today Bill Armitage from Cambridge 105's From the Terraces. And you're here to tell us about an initiative, aren't you, Bill? It's Jez George.
Tim,
Tim! My eyesight is rubbish, you know that. I'm glancing out the corner of my eye. So tell us all about this Mission 676.
Mission 676 is an initiative that Cambridge United are running. And what's actually happening is that Jez George is going to be visiting each one of the 18 English Premier League sides. So we're missing out to Swansea and Cardiff because of the distances involved in doing that. But other than that, he's going to do this 26 marathon walks in 26 days, which bizarrely works out to be exactly the same distance that he originally thought of doing a walk anyway. So we're starting in Gateshead, at the Newcastle United. I think Peter Beardsley is involved in the actual start of it with the club. That's on the day after our final league game of the season this Saturday, so Sunday morning he sets off.
He's getting stuck in right away after the race.
Yeah, yeah. And basically then it's, as I say, every day he's going to be walking 26 miles to head off to another Premier League ground, or in some cases, for instance, the journey from Hull over to Manchester is a 4-day trek, so he's going to be 4 days without a club at that point. But yeah, so he's going to do those 26 marathons. The idea is that we're building on the back of the FA Trophy success. It was pointed out that if every one of the 11,000 Cambridge fans who came to the trophy final, if they donated one penny a mile or 6.76 for the whole thing, then that would be the £100,000 raised from the individuals. And then we're trying to supplement that with £100,000 from business support, which has started to come in. So at the moment, they're looking at a total of about 75,000 already raised before the walks even started.
Wow.
And we're hoping that we can build the momentum over the month of the walk to get as close as possible, if not exceed that £200,000 target.
Excellent. Now tell us more about what this money is going to be spent on.
Okay, so the club itself has had a youth development scheme to bring through elite athletes and players into the club, and that's been running for I think now 8 years, and that's without the funding from the FA, because only league clubs get funding about £250,000 a year. So effectively the £2 million that it's cost has been financed entirely by the club, and it's fantastic in what it's achieved so far, because the youth development scheme, the academy and the scholars are really punching well above their weight. We're playing Premier League sides in the leagues, and really it's a model that's been looked at enviously by a number of clubs at levels higher than us, let alone at our level. But this money that's being raised in the Mission 676 walk, it's about a different thing. It's not about the elite athletes and bringing them through to be future players players at Cambridge United. It's about reaching out into the community. So about 3 years ago, the Youth and Community Trust started, and that's all about outreach into the community and Cambridge's plan to be part of the community. So they currently run things like disability football classes for organisations throughout Cambridge, and various other outreach programmes, programmes with the NHS combating childhood obesity, and also summer and holiday schools where they can do bring youngsters in to play sport. It doesn't necessarily football, they do an open sports programme just to try and get people involved in sport and raising levels of fitness. So the idea is that the £200,000 will form a strong financial platform where they can start to look at who they employ and how they employ people on a more permanent full-time basis to manage the outreach programme and also fund some of the bits and pieces that they want to run as part of that.
Brilliant. So it's really nothing to do with football at all as such?
No, it's about Cambridge. It's about Cambridge United's corporate responsibility in the community. And you know, they've run it on a sort of like a... It would be very insulting to say on an amateur basis, but without a great deal of funding that they've and what they've had, they've managed to raise themselves. And this is to put it on a much more firm footing and get more projects up and running to basically integrate more into the community and provide that way in for, you know, for disadvantaged people within the community to to get involved and see what goes on.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think that you never know where that will lead, actually, do you? When you're doing that kind of thing, you know, it could well give somebody an opportunity, even to get involved with a club and get involved with football that they'd never considered.
Yeah, and it is, and it's interesting as well, because at the moment they run a number of coaching apprenticeships at the club as well. So it gives people who want to get involved in the coaching side a way in, to get involved on a part time basis with the various projects that are going on, and gets them interested in the club. And it carries forward through to a lot of things. So hopefully at the end of 26 days, well, first of all, hopefully Jez will make it. I think he's not doing the elite training, although he's reasonably fit anyway, but hopefully his legs will stand up to it. It is actually the third walk I think he's now done. He started doing this walking back when we played in the playoff finals, I think, against Torquay. He managed to walk, I think that was a 300-mile walk. He did one a couple of years ago for the centenary, and then this is his third one, but this is by far his biggest one.
That's a long way, actually, isn't it?
It's interesting, we noticed they published the itinerary in the programme on the last home game of the season, and it kind of struck home then. You sort of talk about 26 walking marathons in 26 days, and you realise it's a long way, but when you actually see, you know, he's at Hull City on one day, and then there's just four entries, continuing to Manchester, arriving at United and City, that you suddenly realise how far it is. He's going across to Hull, back over to Manchester, then he's going down, I think, to the Midlands, and then he's got a long walk from the Midlands down to Southampton before he comes back up to London, then finishes in Norwich on the 23rd of May, which we're hoping we can cover live on Cambridge 105.
I was going to ask, what kind of coverage that are you going to be at the start, or...?
Yes, so if all goes according to plan, we're going to have a fair bit of coverage on the walk. So the From the Terraces team, or me, will be going up to the final game of the season, and we'll be staying over in Newcastle to cover the start of the walk. Then we'll catch up with Jez somewhere in the Midlands, probably the West Brom visit, around about the 10th, 11th of May. And then, as I say, hopefully we'll feature the arrival in Norwich live. In addition to that, we're going to be taking daily updates, which Julian's going to be playing on the 105 Drive show
about
4:30. And that's going to be repeated. We're talking to Merlin on the breakfast show. He's going to repeat some of that as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll be getting various bits of audio in. Julian had an idea yesterday of getting the club fitness director in to talk about the stresses and strains that Jez will be under as he's doing the walk. So we'll try and build up around that.
I guess he should have quite a good support network, actually, with you know, being around athletes, really.
I heard, and I haven't been able to verify this, I don't know whether people are aware, Eddie Izzard did a 26 running marathons in 26 days some time back.
And I
did hear a rumour that the physio who accompanied Eddie on that is going to accompany Jez. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not.
Right.
It's just
okay.
A fanciful story, but we'll try and find out about that one as well. But yeah, obviously the support of the club, the season's still on, so I'm not quite sure who'll be accompanying him, but obviously you have a physio team, because there's all sorts of, he's got problems with his knee and ankle anyway. way. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it won't aggravate it too much and then they'll actually make it through. But
excellent. Excellent. Okay. We're coming up to the news now, so we're going to have to defer. But that's brilliant. And thank you. Thank you very much, Tim.
No problem.
Got your name right this time. Yeah. Tim Armitage for coming in to tell us all about the Mission 676. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Saturday Breakfast with Ian Dayborn.
I'm going to have a chat now with a lady. Well, she's actually called Nicola, aren't you?
Yeah, Nicola Foley.
Nicola. What's your... Foley, did you say?
Yeah.
Nicola Foley. But your skate name is...
Betty Banshee.
Betty Banshee. Woo! And you've never been on Cambridge 105 before.
No, I haven't. This is my first time. So thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And by way of an introduction, you've come in... You've got up early for a reason, haven't you? Because you're part of Romsey Rockabillies.
Rollerbillies.
Rollerbillies. That's it. Sorry. I knew I was going to do that. Romsey Rollerbillies. Let's tell us what Romsey Rollerbillies are before we kick off or skate off.
So the Romsey Town Rollerbillies are Cambridge's roller derby team. So we're an all-female roller derby team. We've been going since 2007.
Excellent. And so that's roller skating. And what's it? Is it kind of like hockey on roller skates?
Well, there's no ball for starters.
Oh, right. OK.
So roller derby is basically a full contact sport played on quad roller skates. And the game essentially consists of two teams travelling in the same direction on an oval track. You have a pack of skaters, which consists of four blockers from each team. And just behind them, you have one jammer from each team. The job is for the jammer to get through the pack, and she picks up a point from every blocker from the opposing team that she passes. And basically the blockers have to prevent her from getting through, so they have to form defensive walls, and they can throw hip checks, shoulder hits, and basically the jammer's job is to just get through that pack as many times as she can.
Wow. And is it a popular sport in terms of spectators? You get a lot of people along to watch the
game? Usually get a couple of hundred people at our home games, and it's definitely growing in popularity. There's leagues springing up all over the country at the moment. It's one of the fastest growing sports in the world, in fact.
And when you say contact, so you can get your shins bruised and things like that?
Yeah, we have more than bruises occasionally, but well, it's a full contact game played on roller skates, so there's inevitably a bit of a rough and tumble, yeah.
And could you skate before you joined the team, or did you learn?
Only as a kid I skated a bit, but I hadn't put on a pair of roller skates in about 8 years when I joined the team a few years ago. So.
Brilliant. Well, before you go, we'll do a quick, if people want to get involved.
Yep.
But you're doing really well, aren't you? Because you thrashed Oxford, I think, wasn't it, recently?
Yeah, we did. We beat Oxford. It was 211 to 132, and that was the first ever Oxford-Cambridge roller derby game.
Brilliant, yeah. Yeah, so we did better in that than we did in the boat race.
Indeed, yeah.
We won't talk about the boat race. We'll move on. And the game this afternoon is a big one, isn't it?
Yep, so this afternoon we're going to take on Portsmouth Roller Wenches. So I think this is going to be quite a tough game for us. They're a very, very good team, so it's certainly going to be, I think, the toughest game that we've had for a while. And that's at Kelsey Kerridge, and doors are at 2:30, and tickets are £5.
Excellent. And have you ever played the Roller Wenches before?
No, we haven't, and they've got quite a fearsome reputation, so it should be a good game, yeah.
And is it after the game, will you all be mates and go to the bar, or?
Yeah, we will. We've got an after party happening at the Tram Depot pub, and that kicks off at 8 p.m. So I'm sure there'll be lots of roller girls hanging about there tonight.
Hey, if you want to meet a roller girl, if you're exactly. a roller boy. Okay, and if people want to get involved or just go along and watch the game this afternoon, they just turn up, presumably, do they?
Yep, you can just turn up. So doors are at 2:30, but our game doesn't actually kick off until 5:45. We've got a mixed opener game, which is from sort of up-and-coming skaters from a variety of teams like the Norfolk Broad, Suffolk Roller Derby. And so you can come along, you can watch that one that starts at 3:30, and then our game kicks off at 5:45, and anyone can show up. It's good family fun, and it's a brilliant spectator sport.
Brilliant. Oh, that sounds really, really good. Well, listen, thank you ever so much, Nikki or Betty. For coming in and seeing me and telling me all about it, okay, and all the very best with the game this afternoon. That's the Romsey Rollerbillies in action this very afternoon. You heard about it right here on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
All about the city.
Cambridge 105.